Not that all vigilantes were wardens, nor all wardens vigilantes, but a stark naked, armed man on the street was as likely to be wearing a warden's armband as the V.I.G. brassard. Either way, you could count on him shooting at any unexplained excrescence on the human body. Shoot, and investigate afterward. While my hands were being treated and dressed, I was brought up to date concerning the period, it turned out to be 2 weeks, that Mary and I spent at the cabin. By the old man's orders, the doctor gave me a short shot of Tempest before he worked on me, and I spent the time, subjective about 3 days, objective less than an hour, studying stereotapes through an overspeed scanner. This gadget has never been released to the public, though I have heard that it is bootlegged at some of the colleges around examination week. You adjust the speed to match your subjective time rate, or a little faster, and use an audio frequency step-down to let you hear what is being said. It is hard on the eyes, and usually results in a splitting headache, but it is a big help in my profession. It was hard to believe that so much could have happened in so short a time. Take dogs. A vigilante would kill a dog on sight, even though it was not wearing a slug, because it was even money that it would be wearing one before next sunrise, that it would attack a man, and that the Titan would change riders in the dark. A hell of a world where you could not trust dogs. Apparently cats were hardly ever used because of their smaller size. Poor old Pirate was an exceptional case. In Zone Green, dogs were almost never seen now, at least by day. They filtered out of Zone Red at night, traveled in the dark and hid out in the daytime. They kept showing up, even on the coasts. It made one think of the werewolf legends. I made a mental note to apologize to the village doctor who had refused to come to see Mary at night. After, I pasted him one. I scanned dozens of tapes which had been monitored from Zone Red. They fell into 3 time groups. The masquerade period, when the slugs had been continuing the normal broadcasts. A short period of counter-propaganda, during which the slugs had tried to convince citizens in Zone Green that the government had gone crazy. It had not worked, as we had not relayed their casts, just as they had not relayed the president's proclamation. And finally, the current period, in which pretense had been dropped, the masquerade abandoned. According to Dr. McIlvain, the Titans have no true culture of their own. They are parasitic, even in that, and merely adapt the culture they find to their own needs. Maybe he assumes too much, but that is what they did in Zone Red. The slugs would have to maintain the basic economic activity of their victims, since the slugs themselves would starve if the hosts starved. To be sure, they continue that economy with variations that we would not use. That business of processing damaged and excess people into fertilizer plants, for example. But in general, farmers stayed farmers, mechanics went on being mechanics, and bankers were still bankers. That last seems silly, but the experts claim that any division of labor economy requires an accounting system, a money system. I know myself that they use money behind the curtain, so he may be right, but I had never heard of bankers or money among ants or termites. However, there may be lots of things I've never heard of. It is not so obvious why they continued human recreations. Is the desire to be amused a universal need? Or did they learn it from us? The experts on each side of the argument were equally emphatic. I don't know. What they picked from human ideas of fun to keep and improve on does not speak well for the human race, although some of their variations may have merit. That stunt that they pulled in Mexico, for example, of giving the bull an even break with the matador. But most of it just makes one sick at the stomach, and I won't elaborate. I am one of the few who saw even transcriptions on such things. Except for foolhardy folk who still held out in Zone Amber. I saw them professionally. The government monitored all stereocasts from Zone Red, but the transcriptions were suppressed under the old Comstock indecency law. Another example of Mother Knows Best. Though perhaps Mother did know best in this case. I hope that Mary, in her briefing, did not have to look at such things. But Mary would never say so if she had. Or perhaps Mother did not know best. If anything more could have added to the determination of men still free to destroy this foul thing, it would have been the entertainment stereocast from stations inside Zone Red. I recall a boxing match cast from the Will Rogers Memorial Auditorium in Fort Worth. Or perhaps you would call it a wrestling match. In any case, there was a ring and a referee, and two contestants pitted against each other. There were even fouls, i.e., doing anything that might damage the opponent's manager. I mean master. The opponent's slug. Nothing else was a foul. Nothing. It was a man versus a woman, both of them big and husky. She gouged out one of his eyes in the first clinch. But he broke her left wrist, which kept the match on even enough terms to continue. It ended only when one of them had been so weakened by loss of blood that the puppet master could no longer make the slave dance. The woman lost and died, I am sure. For her left breast was almost torn away, and she had bled so much that only emergency surgery and massive transfusions could have saved her, which she did not get. The slugs were transferred to new hosts at the end of the match, and the inert contenders were dragged out. But the male slave had remained active a little longer than the female, slashed and damaged though he was, and he finished the match with a final act of triumph over her, which I soon learned was customary. It seemed to be a signal to turn it into an audience participation show, an orgy, which would make a witch's sabbath seem like a sewing circle. Oh, the slugs had discovered sex, all right. There was one more thing which I saw in this and other tapes, a thing so outrageous, so damnably disgusting that I hesitate even to mention it, though I feel I must. There were men and women here and there among the slaves, humans, if you could call them that, without slugs, trustees, renegades. I hate slugs, but I would turn from killing a slug to kill one such. Our ancestors believed that there were men who would willingly sign compacts with the devil. Our ancestors were partly right. There are men who would, given the chance. Some people refuse to believe that any human being turned renegade. Those who believe did not see the suppressed transcriptions. There was no chance for mistake. As everyone knows, once the masquerade was no longer useful to the slugs, the wearing of clothes was dropped in Zone Red, even more thoroughly than it was under schedule suntan in Zone Green. One could see. In the Fort Worth horror, which I have faintly sketched above, the referee was a renegade. He was much in the camera, and I was able to be absolutely sure. I knew him by sight, a well-known amateur sportsman, a gentleman referee. I shan't mention his name. Not to protect him, but to protect myself. Later on, I killed him. We were losing ground everywhere. That I knew before they finished treating my hands. Ours was a holding action only. Our methods were effective only in stopping the spread of the infection, and not fully effective in that. To fight them directly, we would have to fight our own people, bomb our own cities, with no certainty of killing the humps. What we needed was a selective weapon, one that would kill slugs, but not men, or something that would disable humans or render them unconscious without killing, and thereby permit us to rescue our compatriots. No such weapon was available, though the scientists were all busy on the problem, from the comedy team of McIlvain and Vargas down to the lowliest bottle washer in the Bureau of Standards. A sleep gas would have been perfect, but it is lucky that no such gas was known before the invasion, or the slugs could have used it against us. They would have cut both ways. It must be remembered that the slugs then had as much or more of the military potential of the United States at their disposal as had the free men. Stalemate, with time on the side of the enemy. There were the fools who wanted to H-bomb the cities of the Mississippi Valley right out of existence, like curing a lip cancer by cutting off the head. But they were offset by their twins, who had not seen slugs, did not believe in slugs, and felt that the whole matter was a violation of states' rights, and Schedule Suntan a tyrannical Washington plot. These second sort were fewer each day, not because they changed their minds, but because the vigilantes were awfully eager. Then there was the tertium quid, the flexible mind, the reasonable man who hardly had a mind to change. He favored negotiation. He thought we could do business with the Titans. One such committee, a delegation from the caucus of the opposition party in Congress, actually attempted negotiation. Bypassing the State Department, they got in touch via a linkage rigged across Zone Amber with the governor of Missouri, and were assured of safe conduct and diplomatic immunity. Guarantees from a Titan, but they accepted them. They went to St. Louis, and never came back. They sent messages back. I saw one such. A good rousing speech adding up to, "Come on in, the water is fine." Do steers sign treaties with meat packers? North America was still the only known center of infection, the only action by the United Nations, other than placing the space stations at our disposal, was to remove temporarily to Geneva. No aggression by any other nation was involved, and it was even argued that the slugs, if they existed, were technically an epidemic disease rather than a potential source of war, and therefore of no interest to the Security Council. It was voted, with 23 nations abstaining, to define it as a civil disorder, and to urge each member nation to give such aid as it saw fit to the legitimate governments of the United States, Mexico, and Canada. What each might have seen fit was academic. We did not know what to ask for. It remained a creeping war, a silent war, with battles lost before we knew they were joined. After the debacle of Schedule Counterblast, conventional weapons were hardly used, except in police action in Zone Amber, which was now a double no-man's land on each side of Zone Red, from the trackless Canadian forests to the Mexican deserts. It was almost deserted in the daytime of any life larger than birds and mice, save for our own patrols. At night, our scouts drew back, and the dogs came through. And other things, perhaps. At the time Mary and I arrived back, only one atom bomb had been used in the entire war, and that against a flying saucer that landed near San Francisco, just south of Burlingame. Its destruction was according to doctrine. But the doctrine was now under criticism. The saucer should have been captured for study, so it was argued, if we were to learn enough about our foe to fight successfully. I found my sympathies with those who wanted to shoot first and study later. By the time the dose of Tempest was beginning to wear off, I had a picture of the United States in a shape that I had not imagined even when I was in saturated Kansas City. A country undergoing a terror. Friend might shoot friend, or wife denounce husband Rumor of a Titan could drum up a mob on any street, with old Judge Lynch baying in their van. To rap on a door at night was to invite a blast through the door, rather than a friendly response. Honest folk stayed home. At night, the dogs were out, and others. The fact that most of the rumored discoveries of slugs were baseless made the rumors no less dangerous. It was not exhibitionism which caused many people to prefer outright nudity to the tight and scanty clothing permitted under schedule suntan. Even the skimpiest clothing invited a doubtful second look. A suspicion that might be decided too abruptly. The head and spine armor was never worn now. The slugs had faked it and used it almost at once. And there had been the case of a girl in Seattle. She had been dressed in sandals and a big purse. Nothing else. But a vigilante who apparently had developed a nose for the enemy followed her and noticed that she never, under any circumstances, moved the purse from her right hand, even when she opened it to make change. She lived, for he burned off her arm at the wrist. I suppose that she had a new one grafted on. The supply of such spare parts was almost a glut. The slug was alive, too, when the vigilante opened the purse. But not for long. When I came across this in the briefing, I realized with a shudder that I had not been too safe even in carrying my shorts through the streets. Any slug-sized burden was open to suspicion. The drug had worn off by the time I scanned this incident, and I was back in contact with my surroundings. I mentioned the matter to the nurse. "Mustn't worry," she told me. "It does no good. Now, flex the fingers of your right hand, please." I flexed them while she helped the doctor spray on surrogate skin. I noticed that she was taking no chances. She wore no bra at all, and her, so to speak, shorts were actually more of a G-string. The doctor was dressed about the same. "Wear gloves for rough work," the doctor cautioned, "and come back next week." I thanked them and went to the operations office. I looked for Mary first, but found that she was busy in cosmetics. 25. "Hands all right?" the old man asked when they let me in. "They'll do. False skin for a week. They do a graft job on my ear tomorrow." He looked vexed. "I forgot your ear. There's no time for a graft to heal. Cosmetics will have to fake one for you." "The ear doesn't matter," I told him. "But why bother to fake it? Impersonation job?" "Not exactly. Now that you've been briefed, what do you think of the situation?" I wondered what answer he was fishing for. "Not good," I conceded. "Everybody watching everybody else? Might as well be behind the curtain." "Shucks," I admitted, going overboard. "This is worse. You can usually bribe a communist. But what bribe can you offer a slug?" He commented. "That's an interesting thought. What would constitute a bribe inducement to a Titan?" "Look, that was a rhetorical question. And my restatement of it was not rhetorical. We'll farm it out for theoretical investigation." "Grabbing at straws these days, aren't you?" "Precisely. Now about the rest of your comment. Would you say that it was easier to penetrate and maintain surveillance in the Soviet Union or in Zone Red? Which would you rather tackle?" I eyed him suspiciously. "There's a catch in this. You don't let a man pick his assignment. I asked you for a professional opinion." "I don't have enough data. Tell me, are there slugs behind the curtain?" "That," he answered, "is just what I would like to find out." I suddenly realized that Mary had been right. Agents should not marry. If this job were ever finished, I wanted to hire out to count sheep for a rich insomniac, or something equally soft. "This time of year," I said, "I think I'd want to enter through Canton. Unless you were figuring on a drop." "What makes you think I want you to go into the USSR?" he asked. "We might find out what we want to know quicker and easier in Zone Red." "Hmm?" "Certainly. If there is infection anywhere but in this continent, the Titans in Zone Red must know about it. Why go half around the globe to find out?" I put aside the plans I had been forming to be a Hindu merchant traveling with his wife, and thought about what he was saying. Could be. Could be. "How in the devil can Zone Red be penetrated now?" I asked. "Do I wear a plastic imitation slug on my shoulder blades? They'd catch me the first time I was called on for direct conference, or before." "Don't be a defeatist. 4 agents have gone in already."
"And come back?"
"Well, no, not exactly. That's the rub." "And you want me to be the 5th? Have you decided that I've cluttered up the payroll long enough?" "I think the others used the wrong tactics." "Obviously. The trick is to convince them that you are a renegade. Got any ideas?" The idea was overwhelming, so much so that I did not answer at once. Finally, I burst out, "Why not start me easy? Can't I impersonate a Panama pimp for a while? Or practice being an axe murderer? I have to get in the mood for this thing."
"Easy," he said.
"It may not be practical."
"Hmph.
But you might bring it off. You've had more experience in their ways than any agent I've got. You must be rested up, aside from that little singe you got on your fingers. Or maybe we should drop you near Moscow and let you take a direct look. Think it over. Don't get into a fret about it for maybe another day."
"Thanks. Thank you too much."
I changed the subject. "What have you got planned for Mary?"
"Why don't you stick to your own business?"
"I'm married to her."
"Yes."
"Well, for the love of Pete, is that all you've got to say? Don't you even want to wish me luck?"
"It strikes me," he said slowly, "that you have had all the luck one man could ask for. You have my blessing, for whatever it's worth."
"Oh, well, thanks. I am slow in some ways, but I plead the excuse that I had had much on my mind. Up to that moment, it had not occurred to me that the old man might have had something directly to do with Mary's leave and mine falling together so conveniently." I said, "Look here, Dad."
"Huh?"
It was the second time I had called him that in a month. It seemed to put him on the defensive. "You meant for Mary and me to marry all along. You planned it that way."
Don't be ridiculous. I believe in free will, son, and free choices.
Provided the choice suits you.
See here, we discussed this once before."
"I know we did. Never mind. I'm hardly in a position to be angry about it. It's just that I feel like a prize stallion being led into the pen. Why did you do it? There wasn't sentiment about young love and such twaddle. I know you better than that."
"I did not do anything, I tell you.
As for approving of it, well, the race must go on, so they tell me. If it doesn't, everything else we do is pointless. Even this war."
"Like that, eh? You would send two agents on leave in the middle of a battle to catch yourself a grandson? I did a rapid summing up and added, I'll bet you used a slide rule. He colored. I don't know what you're talking about. You both were entitled to leave. The rest was accidental. Accidents don't happen. Not around you. Never mind. I'm a willing victim. Now about the job. Give me a bit longer to size up the possibilities, if you really mean to let me pick my own method. Meantime, I'll see cosmetics about a rubber ear. I did not see a man about an ear. Not then. For, as I was heading into cosmetics, I met Mary coming out. I had not intended to let myself be surprised into endearments around the section, but I was caught off guard. Darling, they fixed you. She turned slowly around and let me look. Good job, isn't it? It was a good job. I could not tell that her hair had ever been burned. Besides that, they had done a makeup job on her shoulders over the temporary skin that was quite convincing. But I had expected that. It was the hair that fooled me. I touched it gently and examined the hairline on the left side. They must have taken it all off and started fresh. No, they simply matched it. Now you've got your favorite gun cash back. Like this, she said, dimpling. She adjusted her curls with her left hand, and suddenly she had a gun in each hand. And again, I did not know where the second one had come from. That's Papa's good girl. If you ever have to, you can make a living as a nightclub magician. But seriously, don't let a vigilante catch you doing that trick. You might get jumpy. One won't catch me, she assured me solemnly. I wondered about the verb. We went to the staff lounge and found a quiet place to talk. We did not order drinks. We did not seem to need such. We talked over the situation and found that each had been briefed. I did not tell Mary about my proposed assignment, and if she had one, she did not mention it. We were back with the section, and indoctrinated habits are hard to break. Mary, I said suddenly, are you pregnant? It's too early to tell, dear, she answered, searching my eyes. Do you want me to be? Yes. Then I'll try very hard to be. We finally decided to attempt to penetrate the curtain rather than Zone Red. The evaluation group had advised that there was no chance of impersonating a renegade. Their advice would not have stopped the old man, but it agreed with his opinion and mine. The question hinged on, how does a man get to be a renegade? Why do the Titans trust him? The question answers itself. A slug knows its host's mind. Verbal guarantees would mean nothing to a Titan. But if the Titan, for once possessing a man's mind, knows that he is a natural renegade, a man who could be had, then it may suit the slug's purposes to let him be renegade rather than host. But first the slug had to plumb the vileness of the man's mind and be sure of its quality. We did not know this as fact, but as logical necessity. Human logic. But it had to be slug logic, too, since it fitted what the slugs could and could not do. As for me, it was not possible, even under deep hypnotic instruction, to pass myself off to a slug in possession of my mind as a candidate for renegade. So the psych lads decided, and to which I said amen. It saved me from telling the old man that I would not volunteer to let myself be caught by a slug. and it saved him from rigging some damned logical necessity which would force me into volunteering. It may seem illogical that Titans would free a host, even though they knew that the host was the sort who could be owned. But the advantages to them show up through analogy. The commissars will not willingly let any of their slave citizens escape. Nevertheless, they send out thousands of fifth columnists into the territory of free men. Once outside, these agents can choose freedom, and many do, but most of them don't, as we all know too well. They prefer slavery. In the Renegades, the Slugs had a supply of trustworthy fifth columnists. Trustworthy is not the right word, but the English language has no word for this form of vileness. That Zone Green was being penetrated by Renegades was certain, but it is hard to tell a fifth columnist from a custard head. It always has been. The ratio of damn fools to villains is high. So I got ready to go. I took under light hypnosis a refresher in the languages I would need, with emphasis on the sibilant phrases of the latest meanderings of the party line. I was provided with a personality and coached in a trade which would permit me to travel. Repairman for irrigating pumps. And given much money. If it suited me, my trade would let me hint that a pump had been sabotaged. Coercion, intimidation, blackmail and bribery are especially useful behind the curtain. The people have lived under a terror so long that they have no defenses. Their puppet strings are always at hand. I was to be dropped, rather than let to crawl under the curtain. If I failed to report back, other agents would follow. Probably other agents would anyhow, or already had gone. I was not told. What an agent does not know, he cannot divulge, even under drugs. The reporting equipment was a new model, and a joy to have. Ultra-microwave stuff with a directional cavity no bigger than a teacup. And the rest? Power pack and all, hardly larger than a loaf of bread, with the whole thing so well shielded that it would not make a Geiger counter even nervous. Strictly horizon range. I was to aim it at whatever space station was above the horizon. It had to be aimed closely, which required me to seal into my mind the orbital tables of all three space stations and a navigational grid of the territory I was to operate in. The handicap was really its prime advantage. The highly directional quality of the sender meant that it would not be detected, save by wild accident. I had to drop through their screen, but it would be under a blanket of anti-radar window to give their search technicians fits. They would know that something was being dropped, but they would not know what, nor where, nor when, for mine would not be the only blanket, nor the only night of such tactics. Once I had made up my mind whether the USSR was or was not slug-infested, I was to dictate a report to whatever space station was in sight. Line of sight, that is. I can't pick out a space station by eye, and I doubt those who say they can. Report made, I was free to walk, ride, crawl, sneak, and or bribe my way out of it if I could. The only trouble was that I never had a chance to use these preparations. The Past Christian Saucer landed. The Past Christian Saucer was only the third to be seen after landing. Of the first two, the Grinnell Saucer had been concealed by the Slugs, or perhaps it took off again, and the Burlingham Saucer was a radioactive memory. But the Past Christian Saucer was tracked and was seen on the ground almost at once. It was tracked by Space Station Alpha and recorded as an extremely large meteorite, believed to have landed in or near the Gulf of Mexico, which fact was not connected with the Past Christian Saucer until later, but which, when it was, told us why we had failed to spot their landings by radar screen. The saucers came in too fast. The saucers could be seen by radar. The primitive radar of 60-odd years ago had picked them up many times, especially when cruising at atmospheric speeds while scouting this planet. But our modern radar had been improved to the point where saucers could not be seen. Our instruments were too specialized. Electronic instruments follow an almost organic growth toward greater and greater selectivity. All our radar involves discriminator circuits and like gimmicks to enable each type to see what it is supposed to see and not bother with what it should ignore. Traffic block control sees atmospheric traffic only. The defense screen and fire control radars see what they are supposed to see. And fine screen sees a range from atmospheric speeds up to orbiting missiles at 5 miles a second. The core screen overlaps the fine screen, starting down at the lowest wingless missile speed and carrying on up into the highest spaceship speeds relative to Earth and somewhat higher, about 10 miles per second. There are other selectivities, weather radar, harbor radar, and so forth. The point is, none of them sees objects at speeds over 10 miles per second, with the single exception of meteor count radars in the space stations, which are not military, but a research concession granted by the UN to the Association for the Advancement of Science. Consequently, the giant meteor was recorded as such and was not associated with flying saucers until later. But the past Christian saucer was seen to land. The submersible cruiser UNS Robert Fulton, on routine patrol of Zone Red out of Mobile, was 10 miles off Gulfport, with only her receptors showing, when the saucer decelerated and landed. The spaceship popped up on the screens of the cruiser as it dropped from outer space speed, around 53 miles per second, by the space station record, to a speed the cruiser's radars would accept. It came out of nowhere, slowed to zero, and disappeared from the screen. But the operator had a fix on the last blip, less than 20 miles away on the Mississippi coast. The cruiser's skipper was puzzled. The radar track surely could not be a ship, since ships don't decelerate at 50 gravities. It did not occur to him that G's might not matter to a slug. He swung his ship over and took a look. His first dispatch read, "Spaceship landed beach west of Pass Christian, Mississippi." His second was, "Landing force beaching to capture." If I had not been in the section offices, I suppose I would have been left out of the party. As it was, my phone shrilled so that I bumped my head on the study machine I was using and swore. The old man said, "Come at once, move." It was the same party we had started with so many weeks, or was it years, before. The old man, Mary, and myself. We were in the air and heading south at emergency maximum, paying no attention to block controls, and with our transponder sending out the police warning, before the old man told us why. When he did tell us, I said, "Why the family group? You need a full-scale air task force." "It will be there," he answered grimly. Then he grinned, his old wicked grin, an expression I had not seen since it started. "What do you care?" he jibed. "The Kavanaughs are riding again. Hey, Mary?" I snorted. "If you want that sister and brother routine, you had better get another boy." "Just the part where you protect her from dogs and strange men," he answered soberly. "And I do mean dogs, and I do mean strange men. Very strange men. This may be the payoff, son." I started to ask him more, but he went into the operator's compartment, closed the panel, and got busy at the communicator. I turned to Mary. She snuggled up with a little sigh and said, Howdy, bud. I grabbed her. Don't give me that bud stuff, or somebody's going to get a paddling. We were almost shot down by our own boys. Then we picked up an escort of two black angels who throttled back and managed to stay with us. They turned us over to the command ship from which Air Marshal Rexton was watching the action. The command ship matched speeds with us and took us inboard with an anchor loop. I had never done that before. It's disconcerting. Rexton wanted to spank us and send us home, since we were technically civilians. But spanking the old man is a chore. They finally unloaded us, and I squatted our car down on the seawall roadway which borders the gulf along there, scared out of my wits, I should add, for we were buffeted by AA on the way down. There was fighting going on above and all around us, but there was a curious calm near the saucer itself. The Outlander ship loomed up almost over us, not 50 yards away. It was as convincing and as ominous as the plastic board fake in Iowa had been phony. It was a discus in shape, and of great size. It was tilted slightly toward us, for it had grounded partly on one of the magnificent high-stilted old mansions which lined its coast. The house had collapsed, but the saucer was partly supported by the wreckage and by the 6-foot-thick trunk of a tree that had shaded the house. The ship's canted attitude let us see that the upper surface, and what was surely its airlock,